It is my great pleasure to welcome back to Many Rivers Books and Tea my dear friend Grace Kelly Rivera. She is now coming back to us. Last time her talk was about one of her many adventures, the perfumery, a business that she has had going in Grass Valley, California for many years, perhaps expanding to the LA area in the near future, we shall see. But she's come back here because she has this brand new published book, Journey to the Heart of the Maker. I had the pleasure of interviewing her on the radio for almost 2 hours on Saturday. We could have kept going longer and longer. It was a wonderful conversation. Kelly has been an artist. She was born in Ponce, Puerto Rico.
Well said. Well said.
Thank you. I was practicing.
I know.
And grew up in Maryland and spent time on in New York City, where she was developing her artistic bent, and came. Well, she had many encounters with the noumenal and the liminal, and finally met a gentleman who has become her guide in many of these matters at the intersection of art and spiritual practice, Mr. E.J. Gold. And this book talks about, talks just about that work, and I'm really delighted to have her with us. She's also brought some of her art, which I want to make a point of showing you that at the conclusion of every chapter, there is her own reproductions of her, black and white, of course, only, but reproductions of her own art scattered throughout the book. And it's quite beautiful stuff. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about this intersection of art and spiritual practice from someone who has walked the walk for these many decades. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful to see a nice crowd of people here. This is my second time doing a book signing event. And what I did the first time, I think I'd like to do again, which is I'd like to read from the introduction, which tells you a bit of my story and how I got here. And he's right. My whole thing is a lot about artistic creation, but I found that different art forms are like perceptual tools. When I first started out in New York, I thought, I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to be an actress. And no, I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to be an actress. No, I'm going to be an artist. And I was a waitress. A good time, period of time. But I found myself, I went to the Art Students League and I studied at various acting schools, and I could not settle into one artistic form. And I thought there was something wrong with me because of this. What I later came to find out was actually, and now perfumery adds has been added to that, they actually complement one another very much so. And I treat different art forms as perceptual tools. They're different perceptual tools for the science of perception, which is really what I'm interested in. The expansion of my perception. All right? So when I met E.J. Gold, he answered a lot of questions pertaining to this subject, but much more besides. Anyway, let me read a little bit from my introduction, and that way you can get to know me a little and how this all started out. My teacher once described our first encounter as a moment of pure intimacy. It is a perfect description. I was among a large group of seekers at a Zendo in New York City that morning, being led through some unusual movements as we awaited E.J. Gold's arrival. He walked in and passed a few rows of people and came to stop where I was standing. Our eyes locked, and the most incredible thing happened within. It was as though an invisible zipper unzipped me, and a soundless voice offered the contents, saying, "This is what there is to work with." I knew instantly he was the one. He has said that at that moment all the doors were open to me. Moments of such clarity are a delightful treat to folks who walk around as criminally bewildered as I do. Bewilderment is just part of a mystic's life. Bewildering events started happening from very early childhood. I grew accustomed to strange phenomena and knew an active lucid dream life in which I experienced astral projection. There was one such event involving the energetic configuration many call Mary, as in the Blessed Mother, that is of particular interest here. It was a hot night in the middle of July, summer of 1981. After the initial uncomfortable sensations of separation, my body of awareness hovered over the physical body. I felt myself being inexorably pulled in the direction of the window. Outside was a scene that did not correspond to the physical reality I normally knew, the courtyard of an apartment building on 96th Street and Madison Avenue in New York City. Just outside my window at that point seemed now to be on 5th Avenue, somewhere in front of Central Park. It was snowing in the middle of July. Mary was surrounded by people I didn't recognize. Her arms were folding and unfolding, and my awareness seemed to zoom in to this repeated motion when her voice, more than that, her energy beckoned me to come be with EJ and the community. At that time, I had no clue who or what an EJ is. It wasn't until 2 years after this lucid experience that I met him. The significant culmination of the many pointed events that unfolded in those 2 years was the discovery of what I later came to know as prayer absolute, a form of prayer that is done for the benefit of the absolute rather than as a supplication. It is a path that leads to the assumption of the cross of time and space, where one catches an eternal glimpse of creation from the Creator's perspective. It is a path in which I found myself taken up as if by a gigantic hand, one fateful night. Within 2 weeks of the experience, I found myself in the company of the only person I know of on the planet to have described this form of prayer in his writings. Obviously, there were many factors prior to and certainly after meeting Mr. Bold and joining him in California that indicated a connection outside of this time and place. The decision to join him in California was a no-brainer, meaning that, yes, I was out of my mind, and yes, it just had to be. There was simply no question from the point of meeting him as to whether or not I would work with him. That was nearly 3 decades and countless lifetimes ago. One thing about this path that is as sure as rain, there will be many deaths, many hearts, grown and thrown into the sun. A first big taste of the quality of purifying fire that the teacher provides came about around the issue of communication. We were at a different workshop, still in New York, and there was a marvelous talk on the idea of bringing the creation to life, which is an important thing to a person like me who's very interested in creation. Okay? He was making a specific subtle point that at this moment is lost to me, but at the time I seemed to understand well. However, when I was asked by EJ to communicate my understanding, it was clear I lacked the skill to convey it effectively, and he lit into me for lacking the compassion to pass on to others what I knew. It was a stunning moment. He had delivered a shock, the taste of which lasts to this day. Gratefully so, for it helped me formulate the sincere wish to learn how to communicate well and compassionately about this work that answers my heart's deepest calling. I think this body would be dead by now had I not joined the caravan back home. Well, perhaps I am dead in a way. In fact, when a lot of extracurricular events happened at the time of 9/11, I assumed that the precognizant vision, vivid voyaging, lucid dream experiences of falling, informing others we were dead, I assumed these reflected my connection to the event through having worked at Windows on the World on top of World Trade Tower 2. But I was informed by an impeccable authority, E.J. Gold, that in fact I was among the missing. Even with all my bewildering past, this would seem impossible to believe were it not for the direct experience with parallel world personae I've had. All of this to say, I'm very much indebted to that agency that has shown me the great mercy of expanding my perceptual capability beyond the confines my conditioning would have me stay in, and the compassion to lead me to where I might be given some explanation. For whatever reason, it seems I was predestined to have a life that pushed out beyond the box in which it was given conception. Lots of unpleasantness, but the rewards are literally out of this world. Before encountering alternative ideas that put me in search of a teacher, the bewildering events only fueled my sense of isolation, and the knee-jerk response to this was to crave normalcy. Normalcy on this planet often seems to involve a lot of drama. What extraordinary capability I have shown in this game of hide-and-seek, where I bury myself in phenomena, then long for the uncovering. Not for nothing I'm an actress. Well, actually, in fact, it is for nothing I am an actress now. My skills as an actress, combined with visionary capabilities, helped to produce the profound inner theater space that allowed me to enact the ascension onto the cross of time and space through prayer absolute. An electrical experience like prayer absolute seems to have the side effect of compelling one to evolve so that one might be of greater service. Just one facet of the situation can be likened to a little kitten stuck up in a tree, frightened. A person growing a soul feels compelled to help when she sees this. Prayer absolute puts one in a position of seeing. It becomes a little more painful not to evolve than it is to stay complacent in the false security of normalcy, as we normally see it. But for every action, there does seem to be an equal and opposite reaction, and the impulse to evolve will meet with resistance. For me, the evolutionary path is a lot about making friends with that resistance. In making friends, I've become a better student of compassion. In the process of unraveling the false reality structures I have the talent for creating, there has developed a sense of wonder over the incredible creative power at our disposal. There has also developed a gratitude for the great work that offers us the possibility of liberation from the prison that we tend to make with this creative power, and guides us to participate in creation at a much greater scale. But as Rumi would remind me, this path of love requires that I be tricked first. I have been tricked into trying to maintain the identity that seems to emerge time and again from the rubble of the previous incarnation. Eventually, from all the death and rebirth, there seems to have emerged something that speaks to the permanence that we crave, a permanence that reflects the state of constant flux of the primordial being. It is an ever-minimizing identity structure that develops the ability to live multidimensionally. We do kiss a lot of princes along the way to the king, though, don't we? As indicated, it was clear from the beginning of my work with EJ that I had some obligation to learn how to communicate about these ideas effectively. But I had to undergo a lot of demolition work before the one who was capable of fulfilling this obligation was given the space to emerge and develop. Each step along the way has revealed a different nuance of the habit to substantiate the outer world through a process of identification. The demolition work takes place within the constructs of daily life in an evolutionary school. Intentionally created conditions trigger defense mechanisms. Intentionally created conditions trigger defense mechanisms against awakening. At the same time, we are given the reminding factor and force of a living guide to inspire our efforts, in this case, E.J. Gold. The guide is adept at bringing one to the brink of expansion and helping one take the leap. After much repetition of this wind and water way, death, rebirth, changes profound and subtle, one begins to see the miraculous art and craft behind the creation of evolutionary school conditions and how this has been magnificently applied in one's relationship to the guide. The extraordinary skill and method and compassion, these begin dawning on one as the medicine one takes restores the voyager's vision. the heart is opened further by the confoundingly delightful fact that much ado must take place about nothing in order to witness this beauty unfold. One stands in awe, speechless, yet something pries my mouth open to speak. This is how Dear Ubi came about, or so it seems to me at this moment. A form needed to be created through which I could realize another level of my quest to learn how to communicate effectively about this work. After the establishment of the online E.J. Goldsgorebag Justin TV channel and my completion of a show based on his book, which deals with the ideas around objective prayer, a Dear Abby type show around work ideas seemed like the way to go. This seed evolved into the regular noon to one Pacific time Sunday show called Dear Ubi. This book uses as its basis a collection of scripts for the Dear Ubi shows. I should explain that the title Dear Ubi came from EJ, Ubi, O-O-B-E, standing for out-of-body experience. I am a living, walking, out-of-body experience. The show basically consists of readings of writings, my own and others, that treat topics on matters of voluntary evolution and practical work on self. Questions and topic suggestions were given by audience members. Eventually, I was asked about my writings, and thankfully, my dear work buddy Jewel McEnroy helped see that this book was written. I'm fortunate to have received a lot of help. This, like any work endeavor around the school, involves many. It is a group project. To produce the Dear Ubi show requires the work of a dedicated staff, as does the production of this book. I'm honored to be in the company of my compatriots here, and ever grateful for the opportunity to work with and be supported by a committed group of individuals. But there's one individual who stands out greatly, for without him, none of this cooperative work would be possible. EJ once described our relationship by saying that he is my mother, father, brother, teacher, friend, lover, uncle, and sister. When he said this so many years ago, I sensed the truth of what was being said but couldn't begin to fathom the depth of its meaning, a depth that continues to reveal itself. The sacred relationship contains all relationships within it. As indicated, his role has been that of resisting force to my unconscious habits, until, with his incredible skill and grace, enough obstruction was removed to help me stop resisting his resistance so much. With this making friends with resisting force, a growing gratitude is but one effect. How does one possibly express her gratitude for the profound gift of life given by such an enlightened rascal as E.J. Gold? On a very rare occasion, we happened to be taking a stroll alone, and he told me that all he ever wants from anyone is the truth. It is my sincere hope that this book is in keeping with his fundamental wish, reflecting a love that I find to be the only true response to a teacher's magnanimous and constant call to be. That's where I'm coming from. Where are you guys coming from? Oh, do we have artists out here in this crowd? Yeah. Okay. People that... As you can see, my early life was just such a concatenation of different impressions. I lived in a situation where there were street gangs around, you know. It was kind of a rough neighborhood. I didn't have a functional family, and I don't know many people that do. But then there was this God thing that was always happening. I used to be afraid to go to sleep at night because I would have these dreams and these experiences, like giant hands that saying God wants you, this kind of thing. And whenever I would, I took myself to CC, to catechism classes, you know, my family being Puerto Rican, I was raised Catholic, though my parents weren't very religious. I wanted to know about God. And so I actually had a friend of ours enroll me in catechism classes, and I took this very seriously. And then one day, I remember I had a conflict because I would hear all this stuff about how God punishes and you can't do this because God punishes. You know. And then on the other hand, I'd hear all this stuff about God is good, and I couldn't get those things to jive. So I asked the priest. I said, you know, what is this? How can I reconcile this? And he told me, do 3 Our Fathers and 5 Hail Marys, and everything will be better. And it didn't work. It just didn't work. And then one day, I remember I went to the church doors. I was in a lot of trouble, inner turmoil. I was like in third grade or something. And I went to the church, and the church doors were closed. They were locked. And something changed. I knew that was not going to be my path. So I kept on having all of these strange experiences. And meanwhile, my art. You know, I started, I was one of those kids like in grade school, people, you draw this, because I knew how to draw things, you know. I had a skill with that. And I had some theatrical skills. And yet there was a sad part. So at 14, I remember I was sitting at the edge of my bed, and I was having this incredible conscious moment of presence, and everything around me, I could hear all the sounds, I could feel myself breathing, I could smell, and everything had such rich detail, and I knew that I usually lived in a very small part of myself, and I wondered how I could live in this bigger aspect of myself for longer periods of time. So I was sitting there contemplating this, and then I went, well, what am I going to do with my life? And I knew I wanted to do something artistic. I knew it had something to do with art, but, and then suddenly I was flooded with this answer, and there were 2 distinct ideas came through. One, that there was an invisible world, and that some people had a job in the invisible world, and that I had a job in the invisible world. That was one. The other, and this was very matter of fact, no drama, some people were intended to suffer a little more than others, and there was a reason for that. And later, I came to understand suffering in a different way than what I understood at the time. I was very surprised that I was having this thought and that there was no pain attached to the thought. When I was thinking suffering, I wasn't thinking pain. Well, now I think of suffering more in terms, the suffering that I'm talking about, more in terms of to bear. In the old English way term, to bear, as you bear a weight. And the way I see my job in part as a person who is seeking to voluntarily evolve is to expand my capacity for awareness, for consciousness, and bear the weight of creation in that way, to help to bear that weight. Something is the experience I spoke about prayer absolute answered a lot of questions about the suffering. Okay, E.J. Gold is the only person that I know of that has written books that treat what he calls the suffering of the absolute, the suffering of God. Now, you know, here we are. We're in the, you know, we got these bodies, and we got this all this three-dimensional stuff, and it's so groovy. We can interact, and we have time and space, and we can do things in that time and space. But I was given vision of the fact that something is running this show, and it's bearing a weight of sorts. It's bearing a conscious weight. On the night of Prayer Absolute, what happened to me was, actually I have to backtrack. I was working at the Cloisters Museum. Do you know what the Cloisters Museum is? It's in Manhattan. It's in It's at the northernmost tip of Manhattan. There's Fort Tryon Park. And a guy named George Barnard found these cloisters, these pieces of cloisters. Cloisters were are these places in monasteries, you know, they have the pathways and the gardens and oftentimes a fountain. And either they will be enclosed or they'll have like an open in the center and then, anyway. And in monasteries, they are places often where the monks might be allowed to speak depending upon what the order is. So this guy named Barnard, he found these ancient ruins of these cloisters, and he approached Rockefeller. Rockefeller gave him the land and had all of these pieces brought to Fort Tryon Park, and a beautiful medieval art museum was built around them. Okay? But it was kind of, it resembles a Benedictine monastery. So I was working in this beautiful surroundings. And around this time, I started to seek. I started reading fourth way ideas and Sufism and all this. And I was also going to the Art Students League. So I had my sketchbook with me. I was in one of the cloisters. And I was just kind of idly doing something with my seeing how my pencil could shade, the different things that it could do, and I wasn't really paying attention to what I was doing, and all of a sudden this gargoyle emerged out of what I was doing, and then again my consciousness altered and everything both sped up and slowed down at the same time, and I saw that everything I did counted, every breath, every stroke. And by golly, it felt like if I did one more stroke on that gargoyle, it was going to come to life. I felt this electrical thing as though it was going to end me. I got scared. It was fascinating, but I was scared. Okay, so now, I'm working at Windows on the World, on top of the World Trade Center. It was like 2 a.m, and I was wired. You know, I'd just gotten home. So I had this art project going. I went to it, and again I'm working, every breath counts, and my consciousness alters, and all of a sudden it feels like this thing's going to animate. Again, I'm scared. But this time I was sick to death of my fear, just sick of it. So I went, sat on the edge of my couch bed, and I went, what am I afraid of? And in a three, as they say in the fourth way, in a three-centered way, using my mind, body, spirit, my feeling, my intellectual, the moving instinctive, all of me, I produced everything that I thought I was afraid of as fully as I could, and I walked through that. And I kept doing this over and over again until my consciousness started accelerating. And I stopped thinking in terms of even form. My thinking became like mathematical equations and geometrical forms and higher, 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 until suddenly I reached a point, flash of light, and the closest I can come to a thought to pass on to you as to what happened here was, God needs help. I am God. Now, a Catholic girl, I mean, you don't say that to me. You know, blasphemy. It was like the most, but I knew something incredible had just happened to me, but I could not reconcile these thoughts. I'd never had these kinds of thoughts before. 2 weeks later, I met E.J. Cole. And now, he calls it objective prayer, but I had accidentally fallen into this thing called prayer absolute or objective prayer. I went on to perform it with him again. And then later on, after spending some time with him, I got a taste of what he calls the suffering of the absolute, and I'm going to give you this experience now. I was working on my art. I was working in a studio. I had a little studio in a group house in the community. And at the time, we were doing these apprêts. Apprêts are paintings, or copies of, you know, masterworks. I was working on a Rembrandt portrait at the time. And again, you know, as my consciousness does, sometimes it started to accelerate. The space changed. But what started happening was everything around me was alive and conscious and had attention. And that attention was all on me, but it was my attention. There was nothing that was outside of me. There was nothing to climb into to divert myself from that attention. Everything was alive, had attention on me, but that attention was me. I started to panic. I went, oh, let me get into Rembrandt. Oh, I am Rembrandt. See what I mean? There was no escape. I finally got to a place where I almost blacked out, and I literally fell down to my knees, and somehow I crawled out the door, and I crawled down the hallway, and I saw my dear friend Marvette sleeping in a sleeping bag on the floor. I was never so happy to see someone in my life. To this day, I see her with a little smile on my face, no matter what. Because I tell you, it's really nice to have company. Mm-hmm. It really is good to have company. And in some chambers, that's not available. That's been a compelling force. I can't verbalize to you how that has been a compelling force. Now, on the other side of this has been my artistic creation. I always had a bent toward various art forms, and I studied in New York, and a lot of what I studied I had to get rid of in order to be able to work effectively with E.J. Gold, because he uses art forms in a different way than what we have been accustomed or trained to think of artistic creation as being. And one of the key things that I am so grateful for is he really helps you to be who you are in whatever that path is. And he helps you to connect with the creative force. And a big part of the skill that I've learned in the school situation has been how to get myself out of the way so that the force can come through. I'd like to stop here and ask people if they have any questions or anything to say they'd like to ask or say. I've given you a lot, yeah.
Earlier, you mentioned phrase, growing a soul.
Yeah.
Could you expand on that a little bit?
Well, according to, and I'm, you know, I am not very scholarly, so I'm not really good at keeping theories very exact or whatever. But in the work that I do, my view is that one has perhaps, let's call it a seed for a soul, but that a soul is not a given. There's an oversoul, or there's the creator, or there's the essential self, or whatever you want to call that. But as an individualized identity, one has to grow a soul. It's not a given.
What is a soul in this context?
In this context, I would call it, that's a good question, actually. Okay, my concern is to produce an identity, or to be an identity, to find the identity that is like reduced down to the least possible criteria or set of identifying factors, but still an identity that is capable of doing conscious work. Okay, do you understand that? It's for the purpose of, think in terms of cosmic maintenance.
Is this like an identity? I'm
go for
going
it.
Going out at my own limb here.
Absolutely.
But what I get from that is basically trying to pare away all the learnings and the habits of this life in order to get reduced down to some kind of essential selfhood.
Can I say something here?
Yes, absolutely.
My name is Julia Glass, and I'm in the community, and I've worked with, lived with Kelly, and I've lived together for many years.
Yeah,
not
that's right.
Now, but the way that I see it, we were talking on the way up about my background is my parents were both ministers, and I grew up in the Protestant faith, and I just could never quite get the whole thing about that. And when I encountered this set of ideas, what made sense to me and made it like click for me was the idea that, was the idea of grace, like kind of from my Judeo-Christian heritage, the way that I understood it, like grace is something that descends on you. And like, you don't have to do anything about it. It's like this incredible, you know, miraculous gift from God.
Yeah, yeah.
But that never quite made sense to me, because it never seemed to really work. And one of the things about this set of ideas is that in order to receive grace, you actually have to like build a vessel for it. So what I understand like growing a soul to mean is that if we are whole entities as humans, we actually exist on more than one dimension. So we need to build a body that lives in this other dimension. And that's what growing a soul means to me, so that it gives a platform upon which grace can descend and
rest. That's a good way of putting it.
So when we talk about growing a soul, it literally means growing a soul just the same the way that you would, in your mother's womb, grow this body. Then you have to grow another body in another dimension, and then you need to grow another body in another dimension. And that is literally what's meant by saying you have to have the ears to hear and the eyes to see. Because you don't have eyes in another dimension until you grow them. So, and then the Matrix, if anyone's seen the Matrix, the movie The Matrix, like where the guy, he gets out of the little tube and he goes, oh, my eyes hurt, why
do my
eyes
hurt?
Because you've never seen. And that also is, to me, another comment about what suffering is. So when you grow the body, then you learn to see, and it hurts, and you acclimate, and then you become an adult, and then you grow another body. So that's how I see it.
Mm-hmm. So the way you're using body right now, that's interchangeable with the soul we were talking about?
Well, kind of, but that a soul is actually a body in another dimension.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically it. So it wouldn't be body like this, but it would be... from that dimensional perspective, a body.
Well, one picture that EJ gives, or one... of the way it kind of works. From this body, from this shell here, you can produce an astral body. It takes certain conditions, it takes certain substances for that to happen. And one of the key things that has to happen is you make passive the outer world. You use the outer world, okay, such as we are, such as when we come, we fulfill a function, which is the way nature intended. We take higher matter and we as if pump it out into the outer world to make real the outer world, to make it solid and real. Okay? What I'm out to do in growing a soul and doing the work that I'm doing is reverse that pump process. Take the dense and refine it, push it up. Okay, when you make out the outer passive and the inner active, from that, there's a reconciling factor that will take place, the evolutionary reconciling factor, and then from that you produce an astral body. The astral body, in turn, is the shell for yet the ethereal. Is it the etheric or body, you know, or the causal, like that? And so there's a whole picture that is given of how that works, and it requires certain salts, certain substances, certain electrical experiences, impressions, etc., for this process to take place. That's a good. The purpose would be, in my case, the purpose would be to fulfill a certain function. there's work that can be done. Like, remember in the beginning I said that I had this sense that some people had a job in the invisible world, and that I felt a sense like I might be one of those people. Well, there's certain work that is to be done in these areas. Now, I can tell you, it seems likely that I've developed some aspect of my astral being because of some of the experiences I've had that seem to come from in my dream states, but really I'm in a state that is neither dream nor waking a lot of time, and I seem to be functioning in a particular kind of a way. And when this happens to me, I have this feeling as though I'm being trained, like I'm undergoing a training situation. Okay? So there's no, I mean, for some people it might be just because they love the great adventure and they want to explore every aspect of beingness that there is to explore. So they have a human body, and oh my goodness, well, I've got this dream life that I can explore, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
I can give you a different perspective, I think, on what the soul is. A foot is really small. And the earth is really big, and yet where they meet, where the two meet, they meet as equals, and they meet
at the
SOLE.
Uh-huh.
And there's this exchange that's going back and forth between the great big earth and the release, and so it's kind of like the dance floor, or the place where that exchange is going on. And I like thinking of it, the force of that equality, the equality between the two. And the same relationship exists between a word, which has a very brief, very short life, and the silence, because the place where the word and the silence meet, they meet as equals. And that meeting place I see is the SOUL.
Oh, how interesting.
And it has to do with the force of equality and how we live that equality, how we manage to animate and activate that equality in our life, in that space where the equality plays itself through and out. It becomes the body of your soul.
I like that. I like the equality idea, actually. Were you going to say this?
Well, I was just going to say that she asked about, to me, like, what really struck me about what you said, again, is that the concept that there is some absolute being that needs help.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of, with my born-again Christian friends, like, you know, we find this incredible, because we're both fanatics, you know, they relate to me because I'm a fanatic. But then, like, our ideas are completely opposite. You know, that's like the turning point there. And I guess from my perspective, in terms of what I do, there is no use for an astral body or an etheric body unless you have this kind of overbearing need to want to be a friend to the absolute. Mm-hmm. So that it's kind of like the spacesuit you have to put on to get there.
That's it.
To be there when the absolute crawls out of their room looking for company. So that's kind of what you're doing, is you're becoming, striving to be a companion to relieve suffering by learning how to live there. Where that suffering needs to be relieved. So that was kind of what came to me.
Yeah, it's good.
Why do you think you were given that gift, and that most people seem to live their lives pretty much asleep or not even caring or knowing what their job is? Or,
right.
Yeah, what?
I don't know. I don't know. All I know is that when I was young, it felt like a curse.
Mm.
It
when
just
I
felt
first
like a curse.
met EJ and got interested in working with the ideas, and he told me very clearly it's a complete curse to want to be a friend of the absolute. It's like it's really a curse.
Actually, but you know, the thing is that I am so grateful, like I say, that I came into a set of circumstances that would begin to explain to me what the heck has been going on, why it was that, you know, I was astral projecting, why I was seeing Mary under my bed, why, you know, why all of this weird stuff was going on, the relationship between death and these spiritual experiences. And I grew up in a street gang situation. I mean, how could I have gotten, I would have suicided. I would have suicided had it not been for whatever magic brought me to where I needed to go to be able to get some explanation and to begin to develop these latent qualities in me so that they could be useful, because it's like this energy ball that, or something, if you do not find a way of channeling it, it's going to make you crazy. That's what I found, okay? And no matter how much artistic creation I went after, no matter how much sex or how much this or that, nothing was enough. Nothing was doing it for me until finally, I found the set of circumstances where I can begin to pay the debt that I seem to have to pay. You know, when I finally looked and went, okay, I got to go this way. Yes.
Well, I'm still just trying to understand the idea of sort of bearing the suffering, and
it's a tough idea. It really is.
Okay. And I have a spiritual teacher who. She does talk about the suffering of the world right now as we're going through sort of a paradigm shift. And she goes into really deep meditations to what she says is process the pain of the world to sort of help balance or neutralize it or something. I'm not quite sure I totally understand, but it's almost like she helps transmute it. And so is that what you're saying, that you're feeling called to take on some of the suffering of the world?
It's a little different. Uh-huh. Although there's definitely going to be a relationship there. I remember asking once the head of the Franciscan order at the time if they acknowledged the suffering of God, of the suffering of the absolute in their work, and he said, as it is expressed through humans. Okay? So it sounds like this is along the order of what you're talking about. Now, you can look at it, a collection of humans, then there's another potential entity that you can look at there, okay? Many, many humans comprise some entity, all right? And so when you're dealing with it at that level, it's a different thing. What I'm talking about,
yeah, the collective, the collective level.
That's right, and that is something that is addressed, I guess, at certain times. But here's another idea to throw out at you: we're living in a great big labyrinth. We're in the human sector of the labyrinth at this moment, but at any time, if our faculties are facile and the right set of circumstances come about, this set of circumstances could suddenly become a macro set of circumstances. Did you ever see the movie Beetlejuice? Yeah. All right. Yeah. It's a great movie. It's a great movie. One of the things I loved about Beetlejuice, it actually talks about the afterlife and this couple, they die, okay? But what you see is that dimensional realities coexist at the same time. Okay? All right. In one sector of the labyrinth, there is this thing, which is at the chamber at the top, let's call it. There is this thing, this aspect of the primordial being, of God, which is the suffering of the Absolute. And that is going to be addressed not by the whole world, not by everybody, but by some people that seem to be marked to address them. You understand?
I'm getting a hint of it.
Yeah, I don't really understand it in a way, you know?
But I'm sort of catching
it. Yeah, yeah. And so this is something that evidently, for whatever reason, my head was made to turn and look at and see. And it's something that I have to do. Just like, you know, there are people that are walking around, you know, Sister Mother Teresa, she had to see people that were very ill, and she had to, that was her job. She had to work with humans that had horrible situations, and she had to bring them love and healing and whatnot. That was what she saw to do. For whatever reason,
it seems like somewhat of a new concept to me. I mean, just and that I haven't thought about the suffering of God.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of just.
Yeah, it's a strange concept. It really it was to me when it first came about. Yeah.
I've had some very clear teaching from David Hawkins. You know of him. He wrote Map of Human Consciousness, Power versus Force. Most known for that book. Describing that all of this is play that we're creating to think that there's anything that we can do for God. God is total and complete. And there is no labyrinth, and there is no work to be done, that we are just to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
Love.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole entire experience is the slightness of our own minds creating a story for us to fall into.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I felt my safest resonance. And all of these things seem to be extravagant and complicated and confused.
Mm-hmm.
When really it seems like the simplicity of truth is never alienating. And all of these complexities make me feel alienated.
If I'd had my way, I wouldn't be a part of any of these complexities that I'm talking about now. It so happened that I saw something and I just couldn't stop asking, what the heck did I just see?
Right, well, that also is another explanation by David Hawkins, that need to know is this lightness of the mind. And surrendering into totality, that there is nothing to see, there's no one to be, there's nothing to do.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to me to be an ultimate leap.
It seems to be what?
An ultimate leap.
Uh-huh.
With that deep, that's surrender.
See, to my view, that's another chamber. That's potential in the Great Labyrinth. That's another place of godness. That's yet another aspect of godness,
well,
that you describe.
Well, if you want to say absolute, though.
That's a tricky word.
Yeah, you got to be careful with it because it's paradoxical to say something is absolute.
And then talk about it in relative terms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what creates suffering, is making the absolute relative and the relative absolute. So if we're going to use chambers as correct adjectives to describe the experiences that are necessary to your experience and to the experience of others like myself who had very many similar things happen, that feels a lot safer
mm-hmm.
than the word absolute.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There's nothing to do because it is doing itself, but then it becomes you doing itself, so you are doing it. So it's.
But then the suffering's removed from it, right?
Wait. It's like the complexity, like the complex fraction will be working to simplify itself, because it doesn't want to be a complex fraction, because it's when you're too because you get too complex and you're not functional. Mm-hmm. And you need to be reduced down to a certain level of simplicity just to be in the world. So it's doing itself, and it's you doing it, and it's it doing you, and it's just the symphony, and it's in the vision of the conductor that of the symphony that the unity is.
Another thing to make things even more complicated is the fact that, I mean, my experience has been that there's such a thing as parallel worlds, that there are parallel world personae, that this one that you see here is actually a conglomerate. I am existing in multidimensionally, and I've had tastes of this. There are chambers where I am doing some function that I cannot even begin to describe. It is repetitive, it must be done, it's very intricate, and yet I cannot describe it in human terms, what's going on there. I had an experience. I was lying on my biomat, I was like in a hypnagogic state, and then I came out of it, I was awakened, because this being was right there in front of me. A Chinese guy, he looked Chinese, okay, really, and he looked like he was going to come toward me. I screamed, and then it was like one of those. He came around again. He came around, you know? What's that?
I said, we know what it
is. You do? Okay, all right. You know, that did it. he came around again. He performed acupuncture on me. And I asked EJ, I said, you know, what's up with this dude? I see him everyone. And he says, yeah, I've seen him around you for a long time. He's one of your parallel world personae. I don't know what that means, but I do know that I cannot just consider this one here as being the whole of me. And so, therefore, there are many different potential explanations of what the truth is, depending upon where my perspective is at any given time, who I happen to be at that time, where I happen to be residing.
So what is the process that this can be known? Like, why do you have the astral project? Why doesn't everybody astral project or have, you know, are able to view their parallel worlds? But you said there's a process that by which anybody could do to discover that part of themselves?
I think the process of awakening is a reductive process. And what you're basically doing is you're removing out of the way that which doesn't want to be awake. Mm-hmm. You're removing, in our natural state, we are awake. We are. Okay? But we have all these habits, this conditioning. We are addicted to three-dimensional reality. We like our routines, right? When you begin to slough these away, and it's not something that happens that can, to my experience, there has to be some methodology to it. There has to be an expert's eye involved, at least somewhat, in the beginning, until, let's say, the yeast takes or the yogurt takes, and then you are finding your way, okay? Initially, you need some help. You need somebody to guide you who's been there and can begin to say, okay, I'm going to do this. A teacher, the way EJ works, it's not as if he has a method either. I mean, he just takes everyday life, he can see a person if they're on the brink of reaching another level, and he can just give a little at the right time, and you've gone into a new level. But he has to watch you for a period of time before that happens. So as this starts to happen, and you start removing all of these obstacles to the waking state, another big thing that's happening is the human biological machine loves the stability of three-dimensional life. It does not like the awakened state where we might potentially end up in a chamber, in an eternal chamber, which is the one I tasted, an eternal chamber unable to escape. That is one thing that it is afraid of. So you must consciously give it periods of time when it is awake, and you can show it, it can come back to relative sleep, you know, it can go back into the sleeping state and have normalcy again, and you give it little forays like that in a set of conditions, like in a school or whatever, that is safe for it to be able to do that. Gradually, as that happens, you know, we have this thing which in EJ's work they call the chronic defense mechanism against the waking state. And the way you can find that out, have somebody wake you up when you in deep sleep, have somebody wake you up really violently, suddenly. Your first reaction, that's your chronic defense mechanism. Okay? Mine is anger. All right? So whenever I would get close to an awakening experience, my chronic, I would get angry. But if I eventually, when I say that I stopped resisting the resistance so much, eventually I got to be able to see that anger as energy that could be used for my awakening. So I would eventually, you know, I learned how to drop the thing right then and there that I was so identified with, that I was so angry about, drop it, and then suddenly go into a waking state where I saw that thing with a better perspective, let's put it that way.
So, like, in terms of your book,
yeah,
what are we going to find in your book?
Like, yeah,
we've heard a lot about EJ and the thing. So, like, is the books more stories about EJ?
There's
the
you could
go ahead.
Okay. The book has topics. Okay, topic 4. What is the best strategy for accepting others' negative manifestations or manifestations that are unpleasant to be around? Hmm. All right. And I use a combination of my own, I use a lot of my own experiences with EJ, a lot of my own experiences alone, in coming up with examples of how I work with these ideas in a practical way.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to find a lot of hints, a lot of, I mean, people say that it's pretty dense. It's got a lot of information about different methods of working, as well as my experiences and different ideas and their relationship.
So the art that's in the book and some of the art that you've brought with,
yeah,
you can comment more upon the intersection between what's in the book,
yeah,
and these images that are also in the book and the other ones that you happen to have brought with us.
Yeah. When I first met EJ, he saw my art and he thought, oh, she's a, at the time my art was very tight. You know, I could draw you just the way exactly how you look.
It was really realistic.
Very realistic.
Yeah.
Very realistic. And I remember EJ saying to me once, could you draw that guy right there? And I said, yeah. He goes, you want to get to the point where you can't do that anymore. Meaning that I needed to loosen up and I needed to start seeing things more abstractly. And so for a year, right after I had my daughter, we were, you know, times were tight for us and stuff, but EJ had recommended that I get a pelvic bone and that I study it, do nothing but studies of a pelvic bone. And he actually basically bought one for me. Yeah, and I only used charcoal and pen and ink at the time, and I would do these studies, and I'd put it in different positions and stuff like that, and I would do these studies, and I wasn't allowed to do anything but that for about a year. And what ended up happening was I started to see the underlying relationships of things, the underlying structure of things, how a tree grows in a spiral, all kinds of things like this started to become more visible to me, and new juxtapositions that actually had an effect on my the way I see things. Like I see different connections between things, let's just put it that way. So at this point, so I started doing, I would do these illustrations for this publication he had called Talk of the Month. And then, but eventually, what ended up happening was I started to document some of the experiences, or I tried to document, and this is what a lot of my art is about, is trying to document some of the experiences, some of the things that I've seen in my voyages, in which take place sometimes in my dream life and at other times in my activity, a lot of times in my activity in my studio. I have to put myself in a particular kind of state of being. I put a, the way I usually work is I take a canvas and I'll create some kind of a texture. Right now the way I create that texture is by pouring a thin, like over black canvas. I've painted the with black gesso, a canvas black, and then I pour a golden thin coat of another gesso over top of it such that it makes all these textures. And then once I have a texture, I put that canvas up and I stare and I stare and I stare until I see. I have to see. When I see, then it's almost like sculpture. I start pulling it out more.
So show us.
Yeah, so here it is. Okay. Well, actually, you can see. Yeah, let me show you the. These came from very macro-dimensional spaces. I mean, and always it's like, you know, I have these incredible, you know, rich Technicolor, you know, special effects, and I'm trying with my, you know, brush to do. It doesn't jive completely, but I do my best to capture some of the mood and some of the electrical activity of some of these experiences that I have.
Certainly not tight anymore.
No, it's not tight anymore. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And this is Chad. We do a lot of jazz art. We had our stuff at the Mondavi Center during their jazz festival and like that. My Zen pieces.
How is what you experienced different from a shamanic experience?
I don't think it is different, yeah. It
sounded similar.
It's very,
you described
yeah.
It.
Yeah.
When you just, you know, described it,
yeah.
Sounded like that.
Absolutely. EJ has called himself the high-tech shaman.
Yeah. There's more of them out there now, too.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. And they're also mapping.
What's that?
They're mapping. Michael Harner, they're mapping the other realms of consciousness.
Okay.
Because they found that people in shamanic groups and experiences, they'll like be at the same place.
Yes.
They'll be directed to the same place, but they'll, in talking about it, they'll go, oh, I've been there.
Yeah.
I know that place.
Yeah.
So they're mapping it out.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Yep. And then, you know, I do realistic stuff. There's my tighter stuff when I before I met EJ, okay?
And how long ago did you meet EJ? Is this like a long time ago?
Yeah, it's been nearly 3 decades.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been working with him a long time.
The one that you just went by.
This one?
I'm sorry. Can you say something about that piece?
It's called Wedding. This piece, one of the most treasured experiences I've ever had, I'll call it, was being in the garden. Okay? And the experience was that I formed part of the world tree. And so I've done a lot of, like, you'll see couples in union forming the trunk of the tree. Just reliving, you know, trying to show what that was. So, wedding. Yeah, I have a bigger one. I can show you version of that. See in this.
What media?
That was oils. I did that one in oils. I work with oils. I work with acrylics. I do mixed media. And here's more of the jazz art. And that's it, really. This is the thing I did for when we were doing Bunraku. Bunraku, do you know Bunraku puppetry? This is another thing I did. This is a theater thing. Bunraku puppets. Do you remember Topo Jijo from the Ed Sullivan Show? Okay, Topo Jijo was a Bunraku puppet. In Japan, these puppets are about 4 or 5 feet tall. They have three operators, generally. They have, it's called the art form of three. You have the senesen player, is that how you say it? It's a musical instrument. The storyteller, and then the puppets, all right? And they have these beautiful, elaborate stories, and the eyes and some of the mouths can move. And so you have the somebody's operating the head and one of the arms, somebody else is operating the other arm and the body, and somebody is doing the feet. And I tell you, I've seen a genuine Bunraku Japanese show. You are at the edge of your seat. You don't understand what they're saying. Yeah? But you are at the... It's so dramatic. It's so beautiful. Well, EJ Americanized it. He made them out of soft sculptures. Okay? And so we had... And the puppeteers were dressed all in black with black hoods on them against a black backdrop. The puppets were about 5.5, 6 feet tall. So you had... And again, you had somebody operating the head and one of the arms. Somebody had the body and the other arm. And then somebody was at the feet. And you can imagine, to do execute one movement, it took a lot of coordination between the three of us. Boy, when it worked, you could feel the electricity. Honest to God, one day, I was a storyteller. And so I was out on stage and I was waiting for Montgomery. Montgomery was our favorite puppet. He looked like Mr. Magoo. His face looked exactly like Mr. McGee. He's great. And the puppeteers came with the pup. He was alive. They said it was like he was pulling them. And I could feel it was like, whoa. And we had a whole exchange and stuff. And we had a lot of magical things. Let me tell you a little magical story about that real quick. We worked with this book, the Tibetan, the American Book of the Dead, which EJ wrote. And it has a series of non-denominational prayers that reflect the chambers, the 49 chambers of the deathing process. And so EJ's cat, Spook, had died. And he had asked me to do readings for Spook. And so I was doing readings. On this particular day, we were getting ready to do this big tour. And we were having to get a new story for Montgomery. Couldn't figure one out. On this particular day for this reading, I remember I had a dentist appointment. Something happened where I fell asleep and I didn't do the reading. I slept through the time I was supposed to do the reading. But when I woke up, I had this incredible story. And in the story, I saw that Montgomery was going to enter this, I think it was a white chamber. And sure enough, that was the chamber for that day. It was a very kind of magical thing that happened, all right? Mm-hmm. So we went, and we went on tour, and we are there in Washington State, in Seattle, and we're getting ready to go to our gig. And there, over on an overpass, it says in big spray paint, Spook Loves Monty.
Wow.
Nice, huh?
Yeah.
Anybody else? Questions? Answers?
Any of the art?
Yeah. Well, these are just the these are prints. I mean, I didn't have any paintings to bring. And this is just, these are, again, here's that tree thing happening.
The same prints. They're prints.
Yeah, these are just
in different sizes.
The different side. Oh, this is a flamenco piece that I did. I'm a flamenco dancer too. And this is the one.
That one large.
Wedding, yeah.
And then these are just drawings. My guitar player, Bill Paul, I work with. The print, more flamenco. I think that's it. That's it. Everything else you've seen.
Any final questions? Well, thank you so much for this wonderful evening. It's been very interesting, and I'm so delighted you could come.
Me too.
Thank you all for coming tonight. I appreciate the questions and the energy. I want to point out that we have copies of the book right here, as well as some of the media's work as well, and for you to take
somebody
a look at.
Somebody told me it would make a good movie, so you guys... my book would make a good movie. Yeah.
What genre?
Really, exactly. Exactly.
Indeed. We also have a donation bowl on the counter, and we ask people to contribute to it so that we can share with our speaker to further her work as well as to maintain this space for further events such as this. So thank you all for coming out.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.